professor and plow chair of excellence, the School of Audiology and Speech Language Pathology, University of Memphis. He's also a member of our scientific advisory board, as you know, and he's going to explain things that are beyond the comprehension of many, I know for sure for me. So please welcome Kim Aller.
1, 2, 3.
That's not beyond the comprehension of anybody. First thing I should say is that we are now the School of Communication Sciences and Disorders, not the School of Audiology and Speech Language Pathology anymore. As of this month, and Rebecca Wong, who graduated from our program about how long ago? 10 years ago, maybe?
Yeah,
about 10 years ago. She can now refer to her program with a different name. But anyway, it's the School of Communication Sciences and Disorders at the University of Memphis. Okay, well today I'm going to do something that is a kind of a reprise of something that we did at the ASHA convention in November. Probably some of you were there then, and I don't want to do exactly the same thing I did before. And so I'm intending for this to be something of a conversation with the audience, and I have some very helpful faces not far away. Jeff Richards is here, Dong Chen Chu is there, and Charmy Gray is there. And these are people that can help me with some of the difficulties of interpretation that are still involved even for me as someone who sort of plays the role of interpreter for the broader audience of people who are interested in LENA. Of the LENA algorithms that do the segmentation and end up labeling utterances, and that's what we all have to deal in. So I try to interpret that for you. The engineers actually are the ones who program and implement the engineering that makes it possible for this labeling to occur. Jeff and I think, are probably the two people that have played this role of trying to interpret this labeling for the broader audience the most. And so, as I say, I've got some help here. And I don't intend for this to be a monologue. It's perfectly okay for us to have questions throughout in this particular session, and I'd prefer it if you would just feel free to raise your hand if I run into a problem of explanation, or if you run into a problem of understanding. So, first of all, we'll just note that the LENA software does yield a very useful kind of labeling. We already know that. When I say labeling, I'm talking about, of course, these classifications of the different utterances and other kinds of sounds into the 15 categories that we'll end up talking about here in a few moments, and that you all presumably know quite a bit about. And this, incidentally, is a good introduction, hopefully, to the ADEX training session tomorrow, perhaps to either one of them, but I think especially to the preliminary one. If you're already ready for the advanced one, you may not be needing much of what I'm saying today. Jeff thinks you might. Well, we'll see. The proof of the value of this labeling, for me, the primary proof of the value of the labeling doesn't have to do with any of the reliability tests that we'll be talking about or anything of that sort. It has to do with outcome measures that we've already been able to show, and you've heard a fair bit about them. For me, the three that really stick out are that we can predict age of child based on measures that are derived from these automated labelings. We can predict a child's age, and we can do it so well in some cases that it would compete pretty well with, for example, measurement of the child's height in prediction of their age. So we can correlate at about 0.8 between a prediction derived from the LENA labeling, derived from it, not directly the labeling measures, but those that are derived from it. We can predict the child's age extremely well. We can also classify groups, and you've heard a fair bit about that today. We can differentiate autistic children from language-delayed children and from typically developing children, and I'm sure we're going to do very well at other kinds of differentiation as well as soon as we have access to the right kinds of recordings. And we have good correlations, as we've seen in the AVA applications, with other language measures between all sorts of things that we're getting from these automated tools and these other measures of language that we're accustomed to working with. So I'm persuaded to start off with that the labeling is going to be useful regardless of anything that we're going to find out about errors that it makes. because the outcomes themselves are the proof that it's working well enough to be incredibly useful. So at a global level, the system has proven itself very effectively, and more importantly, to me, it's proven that automated analysis of massive samples is here to stay. We're not going to be going back anytime now to just working in the laboratory. I've completely abandoned, for my own part, the idea of doing just laboratory longitudinal analysis of human infant vocalizations. I'm always looking for a way to utilize the power that can be added to those sorts of laboratory efforts by utilization of the automated tools that the LENA system brings with it. So I want to talk with you a little bit about an interpretive subtlety that's a key to understanding the long-term value of this approach, and maybe this is the most important point I can make today. We're going to be focusing on the labeling functions and how to interpret their outcomes appropriately, and we're going to recognize that the methods are designed to I jumped ahead of myself there. I thought that this was a point that the points that are on the screen right now are not the ones that I was talking about a second ago. These are others. So I'll get to that other point in a moment. So we're going to focus on the labeling functions and how to interpret their outcomes appropriately. I don't know how many of you really think very much about how the labeling is done, but we're going to talk about it in some detail. Something you perhaps need to know in order to be able to understand what happens is that the methods are not designed the way you might imagine them to be designed to yield a perfect point-to-point kind of relationship between what your ear hears and what the machine produces. It's not even really designed even that way. It's designed to seek a global solution that's going to cover the whole 16-hour recording. And it wants a solution where the labels that are provided, given certain constraints that we'll talk about, yield the best solution that's possible given the constraints of doing it this way. It doesn't even start out with the hope that it's going to be able to give you a perfect match one-to-one between what a transcriber said and what the system says. Of course, that's the reliability test that we're going to be using to evaluate its performance, or at least one of them. But it doesn't even set out to do that. It actually seeks a solution that looks at a global level, and it's often looking at time windows that cover more than one event. So the labeling at the local level is subordinate to this global accuracy goal, and much of what one sees in real labeled files, when you actually look into your ITS file and you go into transcriber, for example, and you look at how things are coded and you listen to some of those utterances, you're going to find that a very good number of them are wrong. Okay, the mistakes that the software makes then make it necessary for us at the local level to be very intelligent about how we use the information. We need to be aware of the kinds of errors that it makes, and I think it's useful for us to consider exactly how the labeling is done, or to at least get a general idea as to how the labeling is done, to say that even Jeff and I know exactly how it's done is really overstating the case. We don't. I think Dong Shen is probably the only one that knows exactly how it's done. But again, we're trying to interpret the information for you. So we need to think about ways that the software might lead us astray, but at the same time we need to capitalize on the opportunities of the new method and not be swayed by irrelevant traditional thinking that insists on some arbitrary metric of reliability, and that's the point that I wanted to get to. Okay, this is going to be the global point of real consequence here. If you're a psychologist or if you're a speech language pathologist who's had some training in experimental design and done some laboratory work of one sort or another, you're accustomed to the idea that if you have to code things and you're going to use that coding as the measure of outcome in some important study that you're engaged in, that you want to have a nice high kappa value. And the kappa value is going to be the measure of how well your coding agrees with perhaps some other coder or some other external standard of correct categorization of whatever it is that you're categorizing. And we have these, and the kappa is an adjusted value, which ranges from 0 to 1, or actually it can be negative, but typically what you're doing is you're assessing the proportion of times that you agree with some external standard, that your coding agrees with some external standard, either some other coder or some external standard that is, for some obvious reason, the correct one. And we normally want to see a kappa value that's, you know, 0.7, 0.8, 0.9. Well, those sound good. That's 90% of the time if you get 0.9 kappa. 90% of the time, the coding, or you could put it this way, you're doing better than chance by 90%. You're hitting the right answer, the one that conforms to what the external standard says, better than chance 90% of the time, or to the extent of 90%. So 0.9 sounds really good. Now here's what I'm going to tell you. In a situation where you have an automated system like this and you can work with massive samples, you don't need 0.9. At least you don't need 0.9 all the time. Sometimes you can do with, and I'm going to show you examples of it, with 0.2. Why? Because reliability is not like what you think it is. A low kappa is not necessarily the reason to discard anything when you have automated coding. You have to look at outcome comparisons and reason again about the significance of the low reliability factor, because ultimately the issue of the reliability factor is simply based on how well the system is able to differentiate between whatever groups you're trying to compare. Whatever the group comparison is, if the reliability is low, on the observations that you're making in order to try to create this differentiation or to try to discern it, and the N, or the number of samples that you have, is also low, you're going to have a hard time making that differentiation. But even with a low reliability factor in your observations, if your N is large, if you have a big sample, the differentiation between the groups is going to be possible, or it may be, depending on whether the difference is actually there. Reliability is really about power of the test system, of the test that you're trying to make. So whenever you think about trying to test the difference between two groups, you have at least two things to consider. One is, when you make the observations, how accurate are the observations going to be? That's your reliability factor. But that reliability can vary dramatically, and you can still have the power to differentiate between the groups if your N is very large, for example, or if you have some other reason that there's a lot of power. If the effect size was very large in the first place, if the difference between the groups is very large. So reliability in and of itself, there's no arbitrary correct or needed value. When you get into this realm of working in automated comparisons where you have massive sample sizes, you can assess reliability with a whole different attitude. Now there is one requirement, and the requirement is the kappa has to be positive. Right? Because if the kappa is negative, it means you've got a perverse relationship between your coding and the relation and the coding and the correct outcome. Right? So if kappa is negative, it means you're missing it. You're trying to hit the target and you're literally missing it more often than by chance. Right? What you want to do is you want to hit the target more often than by chance, and you don't have to be a whole lot more often than by chance if your N is large enough. So for a lot of the comparisons that you were hearing about today that are being conducted on the LENA database, we have literally millions of utterances that are being analyzed. And so a kappa that's relatively low is actually quite tolerable under those circumstances. So what you have to envision in this new circumstance where you're dealing with data where you don't have to have an arbitrary reliability factor, so just think about the data as they are and go back and forth between the modeling, look at the modeling, how it actually works, look at the outcomes that you get, and reason systematically about what reliability may mean for you in that context. And in some sense, that's what this talk is about for you. I want to tell you about how the labeling is done, and you're going to see all kinds of ways that it can go awry, and I'm trying to encourage you not to be too disturbed by that. Let me give you one empirical example. Okay, of a case where the reliability is low and the outcome is still extremely important and positive. This is a graph that I think is found in the PNAS paper. If it's not in the paper, it's in the supplementary, but it represents simply a correlational portrayal of the relationship between these 12 acoustic parameters that we use to differentiate autistic, language delayed, and typically developing children. In this massive comparison that we did. And this is the simplest comparison. It's a comparison of the three groups on the correlations between each of those parameters and the age of the child. Okay, so how well does each parameter predict the age of the child? And it's just a preliminary kind of data analysis step, but it shows the point I have to make. These are the 12 parameters. This is voicing. This is whether or not the element in question had a canonical syllable characteristic. This is the spectral entropy factor. This is the squeal-like parameter, how high, whether the pitch was too high or not, and so on. It's a whole series of parameters that we use to differentiate these groups. Just 12 of them differentiate these groups extremely well. Now, I've got arrows pointing at two of them, the canonical syllable factor and the squeal factor. And the reason I pointed to them is that I did reliability checks by hand myself. So the Lena Foundation sent me a whole set of 5-minute samples from the three groups. Oops, what happened? Sent me a whole set of 5-minute samples from the three groups. And I listened to those samples, and I was also supplied with the coding that was done. This was essentially all done by Shardy Gray, that yielded the results with regard to each one of these, let's call them syllables. So here was the syllables. The question was it coded as canonical or not canonical? I listened to the syllable and decided whether it should have been coded as canonical or not canonical, and whether it should have been coded as a squeal or not, and so on across the board. And then I went back and I looked at the machine coding that had been supplied by Charmaine's implementation of these 12 parameters. And what we find here, of course, is that the groups differentiate very dramatically on this point, but we only had a kappa for the agreement between me and the machine coding of 0.21. Okay. And on the squeal factor, we only had an agreement factor between me and the machine of something, I think it was 0.26. Okay, it was between 0.2 and 0.3 again. These values would never be accepted in any psychology journal if you're trying to submit a paper that's, you know, they'd say, your reliability is too low. Okay. Now, the problem is that they don't have 3 million utterances, and that's what we had in this analysis. With 3 million utterances, that low kappa corresponded to a probability of being better than chance. I think it was 10 to the minus 10, right? So I mean, it had the p-value had so many zeros in front of it that you don't want to write out the zeros. You use 10 to the minus something to tell you. Even that low kappa value, given the fact that there were 1,200 utterances in this little analysis I did, and they were systematically showing that although I wasn't doing it every time, a lot of times I was wrong, but I was systematically right more often than by chance, 20% more often than by chance. Right? And it was wildly significant statistically. So given that it was positive, the kappa, and given that it was highly significant statistically, you could expect that if we have a large enough N, we might get a nice difference. And indeed we do. Look at it. We've got the autistic group here with a value on that parameter that's way down here, and both the typically developing and language delay groups differ dramatically from that of the autistic group on this parameter, even with 0.21 kappa. And the same was true for the differentiation of the typically developing group, which indeed was low on the squeal parameter. That doesn't matter, it's just, you know, we're looking for ways of differentiating the groups. And both of the other groups. Okay? So kappa level doesn't in and of itself mean a lot. I just learned yesterday from our board meeting that there's another round of reasoning about this that I'm going to be selling to the world if I can. The Sphinx modeling that we're going to be talking about in a minute that is used to supply information about sort of phonemic status, if you will, in these vocalizations of babies or children. The one that's used in the AVA modeling, we're going to talk about that more. It also probably has very low kappa values associated with its coding of various sorts of phonemic types. Probably very low kappa values. But we're seeing data now that suggests that its differentiation of groups is so strong that it must be the same story as the one I just showed you. It must be that even if the kappa values are low, we've got great statistical power behind this because we have such large N. And those kappa values must be positive because it's doing fantastic work in terms of differentiating between groups. So I won't say more about that. I'll just say that this is a long-term story that all of us who are involved in psychological research are going to kind of have to get used to, I think, as we go into the realm of massive sample sizes. The traditional rules of thumb about reliability level, you know, moderate reliability is between what, 0.4 and 0.6, you know, and between 0.4 and 0.2 is fair reliability, and under 0.2 is poor, okay? Well, I assert we're going to see times when we get reliability below 0.2 and it's still going to work just fine for our purposes. Or at least it's going to work, it's going to be workable for certain kinds of comparisons and be very a very powerful tool for us. Okay, so let's talk about how this process of labeling is actually done. So we start with a waveform, and the waveform goes into the LENA DLP, which is the recorder, and then it goes through a process that we call feature extraction. It's really just a textual analysis, so the waveform is transformed into a form that's going to be more amenable to the kind of process of segmentation that is at stake. And then we begin this process we're going to call segmentation. What do we put next? And the product of that segmentation is going to be a set of segment types, eight of them in particular, which you've heard about. But the question is exactly how it's done. And I want to give you just a little feel for this, how it's done. So the process is based on what are called Gaussian mixture models. So think of a Gaussian mixture model as a Gaussian mixture model is a little guy who starts off with a random characteristic, okay? And we got eight of them, eight little guys with a random characteristic with regard to acoustics that's sort of built into them. They just stand there waiting for some kind of information. And now we're going to start presenting them with information. And the information is going to be coded stuff. So it's going to be waveforms, or no, it's going to be, I guess, this feature extracted stuff. But it's going to have a label on it because the transcribers in Kim Coulter's group have transcribed it, and they've laid labels on those acoustic signals that correspond to the eight labels that we're going to be looking for. So female adult, male adult, child wearing the device for key child not wearing the device, other child, and so on. So they've got everything that gets presented to each one of these little models has a label on it. Okay, and the little model is going to start getting adjusted. Every time a signal is presented to it, it tells it, this is one of you or it isn't, right? If it is one of you, make a little adjustment in yourself to come closer so that your acoustic characteristic is no longer random. It's a little more like the characteristic of this utterance that just got presented to you, right? And this just happens over and over and over and over. This sort of cyclic and iterative pattern. And gradually, these little models all come to differentiate themselves. They don't look like alike anymore. They started off looking all just alike as they were all random. Right? But the little model of the male adult comes to look just like me. And the little model of the female adult comes to look just like Kim. That's two Kims, but male and female. And so on. So you end up with models that actually have acoustic characteristics that in some interesting and composite way represent characteristics of all the stuff that they've been presented with. It's some kind of a composite of that. And these are literally the models that are going to be doing the segmenting. I mean, they're the basis, ultimately, for how the segmenting is going to get done. They simply adjusted their acoustic characteristics to look like all of these coded things that have been coming in. So the output of that segmentation, then, is a set of adult segments, the female adult and the male adult, the key child segments, and then some other segments, the other child and the noise, the overlap, all these other things. Okay. Now, after this initial round of labeling is done, the adult segments get submitted to the Sphinx phone decoder. Now, I'm going to tell you a little more about the Sphinx phone decoder, because some people will tell you that the labeling is dependent on the Sphinx decoder. Some people who are working with LENA, I've heard them say it to me. Okay, that's wrong. Okay, the Sphinx decoder is not the basis for the labeling. The Sphinx decoder does some things after the labeling has been done. So one thing that the Sphinx decoder does is that it goes into the adult segments and it asks the question, how often does this phoneme occur? How often does this phoneme occur? How often does this phoneme occur? And so on. It just asks these questions over and over. How kind. And there are 46 of these little models. They're also Gaussian mixture models, right? I'm looking at Dong Shin. Yeah, they're fundamentally, he says. I knew he would have some kind of qualification. All right, so anyway, there are 46 of these. About 40 of them represent actual phonemes in English, and the other six represent
other kinds of noises that may occur from the voice, like coughing and things of that sort. All right, so you've got these,
so the adult segments are going to get categorized in terms of how often certain phonemes occur, and on the basis of the occurrence, the frequency of occurrence of those phonemes across the session, they're going to actually make an estimate of the adult word count, and that's where the adult word count is going to come from. It's going to come from how often certain phonemes are occurring, how frequently they occur. The adult word count comes from an analysis of the Sphinx decoder data after the adult segments have already been identified. Okay? Another thing that happens from the adult segments is the adult segments get submitted to the conversational terms processing unit, which also, of course, has to have information coming up from the key child segment information, and it has to have other segments as well for reasons that we'll talk about. The key child segments now are going to go into a whole new kind of processing because they get some real special treatment. And in essence, they're going to get broken down into cries, what we call fixed and vegetative sounds, and then the vocalizations that interest us the most, the ones that that get called child vocalizations, right, in the legal reports. And these are the ones that I refer to as the speech-related child utterances. Okay? And then there's some other processing for some of the other segments as well. Okay, so the Sphinx decoder now is going to yield the basis for our adult word count. The conversational terms processing is going to go through a whole bunch of stuff where it compares on a basis that we'll talk about where the key child segments are with regard to the adult segments, and it's going to yield the terms estimate. And the key child segments are going to yield a key child vocalization count, which is this vocalization count or child vocalizations that you see in Molina reports. And there's some other output stuff that's going to come out of the other segments as well. And of course, all of these things contribute to the display reports and the ITS file. How many of you ever look at an ITS file? Yeah. For those of you who don't ever look at an ITS file, you're probably going to need to at some point, or maybe you will. If you don't ever look at an ITS file, your brain will probably be more comfortable, especially if you can do it with somebody sitting next to you that knows how to kind of interpret what it is. I mean, it looks like programming gobbledygook when you first look at it. But it's actually a quite simply structured system that tells you how all of the coding was done, how all the segmentation and labeling was done, and all of the information that goes into all of this decision making is actually in the ITS file. And the ITS file is the basis for the ABEX, too. ITS file supplies the information that ADEX will use so that you can do all kinds of analyses that go beyond what's supplied in the standard reports. So the Lena reports are actually primarily based on these three components that are the output of post-segmentation work. And ADEX draws on both the stuff that's in the ITS file and all of these reports and all of the stuff that's also coded in the reports, plus information directly from the segmentation. Okay, so there are eight categories of segment or label that we deal with, the basic ones. And then there's a near-far distinction that gets superimposed that will yield ultimately 15 categories. Everything except silence gets broken down into two subcategories, either near or far. Maybe I should say right now what near and far means. It doesn't mean necessarily that in one case the voice is near the child and in the other case the voice is far away from the child. We even have a category, child far, key child far, right? He can't get far, he's always close to the microphone. If he's wearing the microphone, he's not far. But there's a category, child far. So far doesn't really mean far. It means something like not highly salient with regard to what it would have been if it had been silence. And we'll tell you a little more about what that means in a minute. It's really based on a judgment of that the machine makes as to how likely it was that this was a child utterance as opposed to being silence. And if that ratio is too close, if the silence probability is too high with respect to the child's utterance probability, then we're going to call it child far, meaning it's not a very salient child. Okay, and that's the same thing with the designation far on the adult utterances as well. They don't really mean that necessarily the parent is far away. It means the parent, maybe it means the parent is talking quietly. And consequently, you get this relationship between the silence, the silence probability and the mother probability that's close again, or something like that. Daoxin wants to make a comment, and please do. Talk loud for me. Yeah, with the adult data, of course, that's true. It's going to correlate with whether you're near or far. So if you are far away, you're going to have a low signal-to-noise ratio, and it's going to end up being more likely to get too close to the silence probability. And then you.
Let's put it in another way. The majority of machine generation, the real segment, is probably true.
He has lots of faith in the machine. I usually want to have concrete, quantitative information that proves this faith. But I'm sure he's right that most of the time this does correlate with near and far, except in the case of the child that's wearing the device, because he doesn't move away from the microphone. The microphone's on him, right? So in his case, it's very clear that the term far is in some sense a little misleading. The key point is salience, I think. One of the great advantages of using a recorder that's on the child, and the Lena is always based on this, at least thus far, is that it provides us a basis for systematically filtering out information that probably isn't significant in the child, either the child's output or the child's input. Because it acts like it's far away, or it acts like it's low in salience, or it acts like it's not close enough to the child, it's not enough in salience to have any really significant impact. We presume that most of the child-directed speech is going to be in the near category, not in the far category. So an awful lot of the stuff that occurs with a parent right next to the child is presumably directed to the child. Now with the mom holding the child in one arm and talking on the telephone in the other, we have a contradiction to that. But that we presume is a relatively rare circumstance. And that most of the time when we have female adult near or male adult near, what we have is information that's likely directed towards the child. Charmaine.
I have a comment about the child far speech, because sometimes the microphone
gets obstructed. Yeah, so, right, that's a very good point. So there's another way that you could get that signal-to-noise ratio could be foiled by just having the child could put his hand over the microphone, or for some reason they could put on a heavy coat, and you don't know that there's been a heavy coat put on, and again, that could change the probabilities that you get. Okay. Within the key child, there are these three additional distinctions. There are three distinctions. So within key child utterances, as I said before, we have the ones that are called child vocalizations, or as I said, SCUs, that's speech-related child utterances. We have cries, so there's a specific model for cries. So I told you about eight Gaussian mixture models. There's actually a Gaussian mixture model for cry, and another one for vegetative and fixed signals, correct? And for child vocalization, for all three of them, but I mean, we've got additional ones for categories that you might not have thought they needed special models, but they do. They have to have special Gaussian mixture models as well, but they're just applied within the child vocalizations once the child, I mean, within the child segments, once the child segments are identified.
We have models
for each age, too. So they're age-specific models. Okay, so now here's some more topics that may surprise you a little. The duration, the minimum duration for any of these labels is in fact fixed at a certain level, and it's not the same level for each one of them. You may just want to know this, because if you start looking through using Transcriber at some of the data that you come up with, you may find it kind of odd that you never see really, really short things, because really short things do occur. But in order to be labeled male adult or female adult or TV or overlap, you got to be at least 100 milliseconds long. That's a full second. Okay? In order to be labeled silence or noise or other child, you got to be at least 800 milliseconds long. And in order to get labeled as the child wearing the device, you got to be at least 600 milliseconds long. Okay, now, you might think of this as another way that the Lena system imposes a requirement of salience. Because it's not going to allow some utterance or some event that's really, really short in duration to be the focus of too much attention. Hopefully, such short events aren't playing a lot of role in either how the parent responds to the child's vocalizations or the child, or how the child responds to the adult's vocalizations. Hopefully, they're not having that kind of role. At least that's the sort of assumption that lies behind, in a way, utilizing this kind of approach. But I think it's fair to say that that's not really the primary reason that we have these limitations. The primary reasons are based on an engineering requirement and the requirement of getting high reliability, or getting as high reliability as we can between the coding that was done by the humans and the coding that's done by the machine. And so Dong Xian tried many iterations of different ways of doing this labeling, utilizing different kinds of duration constraints. And this particular configuration of duration constraints actually yielded a very good result. So it's kind of been instantiated as our standard because it worked. It does, however, as I said, have the felicitous characteristic that it corresponds to some extent to this assumption that what we want to do is we want to focus our labeling on the things that are salient, both in the child's output and in the input to the child. And things have to be relatively long in order for that to happen. Now, I don't want to give you the wrong impression. The duration of those, that minimum duration requirement doesn't actually mean exactly that if you listen to a child vocalization, for example, that it has to be at least 600 milliseconds long. The vocalization itself, the way you hear it, has to be 600 milliseconds long in order for it to have gotten categorized that way. Because remember, with the child vocalization, there are three subcategories that are possible. So the child might say, da-da, and then cry for a few seconds, or cry for an instant, right? Say, da-da, and then cry for an instant, and both of those things get categorized in it, and da-da is a lot shorter than 600 milliseconds. But the thing got labeled as CHN, because the cry that went along with it, that happened very shortly thereafter, also got included in the child vocalization. So you had a relatively short vocalization of the child that did get incorporated, did get labeled properly, okay? It's also true that even with something like a female adult utterance, that you, and I've looked at them and I've seen them using transcriber, you may find an instance where even though a segment that's 1,000 milliseconds or more in duration is labeled female adult, only some proportion of it is actually the female adult. There's some silence mixed in, there's some other kinds of sounds mixed in. All it means during that, say, 1,200 millisecond period that got labeled as a female adult is that during that period, the maximum likelihood that was assigned by those eight Gaussian mixture models went in the way of the female adult voice. The female adult won the contest for being the best model of this 1,200 millisecond sequence. That's really all it means, okay? So you can get shorter stuff within there, but you can't get a label for female adult that's shorter than 1,000 milliseconds. So that applies, in fact, to all of these categories. Remember that the labels don't mean that every single moment within the sequence that has been labeled as X are X, right? It's going to mean that across that sequence, it won the contest against the other seven models for being the best model of that particular sequence, okay? The special category of overlap. Yeah, overlap is a really interesting category, and it's an absolutely necessary one in a circumstance like this, because you can't have 1,000 models. And whenever one voice is talking over another, or one voice is talking over noise, all kinds of things that can happen, a voice and a barking dog, you've got a special problem. And the easiest way to solve this appears to be to just have a kind of special category that absorbs an awful lot of slop in one place, and that's the overlap category. Now, in we'll say some more about the overlap category in a minute, and I'm going to not go too slow. I'm going too slow. The start and end times of labeled events are not also going to be absolutely right. If you start looking in your its file and you go into transcriber and you start looking at where an utterance starts and you listen, you say, wait a minute, that utterance started back here. It didn't start there. Right? That's where the labeling says it starts, but it really started back here. Or you see the labeling starts here, but the utterance doesn't actually start till over here. This is going to happen a lot. Okay? Because the labeling is simply not asking the question in this completely point-to-point way. It's asking a much more global question across a variety of information, and think of it in terms of broad scale information, at least twice the size of the minimum duration. It's looking across a window of that size, and it's finding a solution that fits the whole realm. And so it's not necessarily going to hit very well right at the start of end times. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things that I felt the most complaint about the very first time I examined these things, was how often they seemed to miss right at the start points. I wanted to get right, you know, when it said pa, I wanted to get the onset time right at the beginning of the P. Sometimes it does, of course, but sometimes it doesn't. Don't worry about that too much is my suggestion. Okay, you all know what vocal activity blocks are, I presume. Vocal activity blocks are our way of sort of organizing the file after we've already got the segmentation done, because we're not just interested in the segments themselves, we're interested in something like conversations. We're interested in how the child and parent are organizing their interaction. And in some cases, we're interested in how the child is organizing his monologues. So we have this so-called five-second rule, and it didn't come out of the blue. It comes from a literature on interaction, you know, adult vocal interaction. And the way it works is this, that if you're having a conversation with somebody, typically you talk for a few moments and you kind of give us some kinds of nonverbal signals and verbal signals. I'm about ready to finish with what I'm saying. And when you do finish it, the other guy already knows that you're finishing. He picks up right away with the next part of the conversation. Often he even overlaps, you know, kind of cuts in on you a little bit. But you just stay right together, and there's a kind of somebody talked about a dance here earlier, wasn't it, Robin? There's a dance that goes on between people who are talking to each other. And you know what doesn't happen in these conversations? Long silences. And a silence as long as 5 seconds is a real marker that things have come to an end. This conversation is over. either I've had it, or no. It's more a question of, it's just sort of like it's a natural marker of the ending of a thought group that was organized into a whole conversation, an interaction. And oftentimes people will then start up a new conversation. And even if they pick up the same topic again, the sense you have when they pick it up after 5 seconds of silence is that they're reinitiating the topic. It's not that it's a continuation of the same thing. There really is a sense that this sort of 5 second rule works. At least this is what the literature tells us. So that's the rule we used. If you have 5 seconds of silence, or let's just call it garbage, 5 seconds of stuff that's not a part of the conversation, or more, then we're going to say we're starting a new conversation the next time people start talking to each other. So the boundary between vocal activity blocks for conversations it's always bounded by at least 5 seconds on either side of stuff that's not related to this conversation. Other durational constraints. Okay, I'm going to just make this faster because the time is running out on us. A child vocalization can actually be as short as 50 milliseconds if it's embedded within a longer vocalization that includes a bunch of other stuff. And it can't have a silence within it longer than 300 milliseconds, or else it's going to get categorized as a new vocalization within that longer segment. And when I say a new vocalization, I mean a new utterance within the CHM. Okay? Remember, a child, I'm going to show you pictures in a second, and we'll do it better. So the absolute minimum for a child vocalization is 50 milliseconds. And 300 milliseconds is the maximum break within a child vocalization. And where does that 300 milliseconds come from? Well, that's the sort of the typical duration of a syllable. You don't want to have a syllable. I mean, you don't want to have a break within an utterance that's as long as a syllable. You only want it to be as long as a consonant, right? So the longest consonant you can get just about and have it seem natural is about 300 milliseconds. More typically, it's going to be 150 or even shorter. So the closures you get during producing the same utterance that make everything go to silence are typically much shorter than 300 milliseconds. If you get 300 milliseconds, then we say it's a new utterance, a new child vocalization has started. Just like we use the 5-second rule for conversations, we use a 300 millisecond rule for the child vocalizations. So when a silence longer than 300 milliseconds occurs within a CHN or a CHF, a new child vocalization begins. Okay, now let's look at an actual segmentation. So this is a waveform. And here are sort of putative spots where the thing was segmented. And here are the labels that were given to this in this putative segmentation that Jeff supplied me with. Now, because this little silence, which is the shortest one, is right here, you know that this time period must be longer than, I'm sorry, that's not right. Now, there. Now that we have in the markers for the vocal activity blocks, okay, this is the beginning of a vocal activity block, this is the end of one. So this silence has to be longer than 5 seconds, right? We just concluded that. This is a vocal activity block, and it has no silence within it as long as this silence. It does have a silence there, and it's just a little shorter than that one, so this one is just about, probably just about 5 seconds. So this is human vocal activity, so this is a vocal activity block, this is another one, and this is a break between two of them. And these are pauses, okay? This, a pause that just barely meets the requirement of pause length, and this a pause that's much longer than that, okay? So that's the way vocal activity blocks look. This is simply an illustration that when the segmentation goes on, and in the ITS file, you also have a record of where each 5-minute block is. It's kept track of within the ITS file. And elapsed time is kept track of both in terms of real clock time, and which is uses a real-time clock based on, what is it, Greenwich Mean Time or something like that? Yeah. And then an elapsed time that starts at the beginning of the recording and runs continuously. So you have both of those. But that's not a terribly important thing for you. Now, what I want to do right now, gee whiz. So, all right, a short list of common errors, but then I want to show you one more of these examples of how we break things down. Some really common errors that you'll find if you do start looking at the transcription files is ones where the mom is imitating the baby and she gets misidentified as the baby. And if some people are nodding like they've already seen this happen. And you can expect it to happen because moms are really good at this sometimes. I mean, the child will squeal and the mom will go straight to the same pitch. I mean, they'll really match pitches. And sometimes the kid will do it towards the mom too. The child will come down to the mother's pitch. We've seen examples of both of those sorts. And so this is one of the common errors that we see. It's a kind of a vexing one because for those of us who want to study imitation, it puts a crimp in our style. We're going to have to do some extra work. Another thing is noise gets mistaken for speech or other vocalization. You have labels that contain additional vocalizations that don't pertain to the label. So even though we have an overlap category, overlap gets missed. So a vocalization gets categorized as female adult, right? It's female adult and then some child, and then some female adult and then some child. You know, just this is a common error. Right? Sometimes it just can't tell the difference and it labels a whole sequence, which is actually a mixed sequence as one kind of voice. Sometimes the label is just wrong. And the worst example I found when I did the 1200 utterances reliability study for the PNAS paper was a barking dog that was identified as the mother's voice. And I thought it was really, really strange when I looked at it. But then I talked with Jeff about it and he said, well, consider the fact we have no model for the barking dog. We've got 8 Gaussian mixture models. None of them is barking dog. This is an forced choice task. It has to be categorized as one of these 8. It doesn't have the choice to go to barking dog. Abby.
I was just going to say, you know, speak and say, instead of the child, model for a speak and say.
Yeah, a speak and say. Well, now that should have gone, if it had been... It should have gone to the TV. If ideally, right, it would have gone to TV. Speak and say. Ideally, it would have gone to TV. But But this is what you have when you've got an eight choice model.
So very quickly, here's another waveform where I want to show you what happens with the child vocalizations. So this label stands for child utterance, a child utterance cluster, or a CHM, if you will. Okay, so this is a CHM. And this is another CHM, and this is a female adult. And here we have a silence that's 900 milliseconds long. Okay? So, since it's 900 milliseconds long, it's long enough, it is literally labeled as a silence. It's long enough to be a silence. What's the limit on a silence? I think it has to be 800, right? Silence has to be 800 milliseconds. So this one's 900. It classifies as a silence. So this is one CHM and this is another one. But within each CHM, there's some more information for us. So now we're going to zoom in on the first of those CHMs. And this is the same one, just zoomed in on. Okay. And that thing is going to get broken down into other subcategories, and I want you to see how you can still have silence within these things. Okay? So, first of all, this is the whole first CHM. Okay? Now, here's the breakdown within that. Remember, you can't have one utterance that has a silence as long as 300 milliseconds in it. So since this silence right here is 400 milliseconds long, this is actually one child utterance, and this is a second one. Okay, and this silence is also longer than 300 milliseconds, so this is a third child utterance within one CHM. Okay, now let's look at the labels on those that are derived from the secondary labeling. Right, the first one, this corresponds to the PNAS paper's actual additional labeling. Okay, it actually broke this thing down into two syllables for us. Okay, here's the first syllable, and here's the second one. This is the first syllable of the first utterance, and this is the second syllable of it. And this is the silence in between, which is 200 milliseconds long. It doesn't go over the 300 millisecond limit. It's interpreted as a consonant. Okay? So this is like the beginning of the thing. It's maybe ba, ba, or something. You know? So this is a vocalization where it fits together as a single utterance, but then there's a silence that's long enough that the second thing is treated as another utterance. Okay? And the third thing, the interesting point here is that that one is not categorized as being speech-related. It's categorized as a vegetative. It may be like a cough or something. Okay. My bet is that since the last one is categorized as a cry, that it was something like this. See what I mean? And because the beginning of a cry often starts with something that sounds a little cough-like. I mean, we've been seeing this in our laboratory research over and over. And it's a good bet as to what happens. The reason for presenting the example is just to show you that you don't have just a consistent something inside these utterances. Sometimes inside these CHNs you've got a lot of action going on. And the software and the ABEX procedures can provide you with a lot of information about what's going on inside them. Okay, I'm skipping a couple of things because I want to just say a teeny bit about the reliability of the and how it was assessed. There was actually 230 hours worth of stuff that was transcribed by Kim and her team that went into the training of those eight models. Remember, we got the eight models that get presented with a bunch of stuff. What did they get presented with? 230 hours of transcribed stuff. So they got presented with lots and lots of models of each of the types that they were supposed to be learning how to imitate, so to speak. After the training was done, then we start the process of testing to see how well the model works. And that requires an additional transcribed sample. And this is the cleanest of the transcribed samples. And it's 70 hours of stuff where they took six 10-minute chunks from 70 children that were balanced for gender and age across the original LENA natural language sample. Okay? So it takes the whole age range from something like 2 to 48 months. Yep. And sort of, in some sense, kind of balanced selection, it uses a balanced selection process of 10-minute chunks, six of them from each of 70 different children at balanced across these ages and genders. So when the segmentation is being done, they actually do have the segmentation in front of them, but I trust Kim. She says, we didn't take those segmentations that were provided for us by the machine seriously at all. We were changing them right and left, and we were moving the boundaries almost in every instance. So They went through these 70 hours and they gave them labels that they felt were the correct ones, and they did this in such a way that they relabeled most of the time, or at least shifted boundaries most of the time. And the lead transcriber, who would have been Kim, reviewed every segment in the 70 hours before submitting the stuff to the reliability tests. The transcribers were being encouraged all along to be critical of the machine labeling. And the transcription showed events violating the minimum duration constraints too. So they were not required, when they did a female adult vocalization, to have it be 1,000 milliseconds long. They could have it be shorter. Okay. So when the reliability test gets done, it doesn't have some artificial requirement that things match in duration the constraints that the machine is going to live under. Now, the comparison between the machine level stuff and the transcribers was done at the frame level afterwards. And when I say frame, I mean 10 millisecond frames. So for every frame, it asks, what did the machine say? What label corresponds to this 10 millisecond frame by the machine? And what label corresponds to that 10 millisecond frame by the human transcribers? Okay. And then it shifts 10 milliseconds and asks the same question. It keeps doing that. It has a collar guard right at the edges of utterances that's 30 milliseconds long, and I'll not explain what that means. However, the agreement is actually pretty good in most cases. It comes to about a 0.7 level agreement, 70% agreement across various cells and various matrices, and there are a lot of ways to look at these matrices of classification, where the machine classification is compared to the human classification. In the A classification here, the human listener is assumed to be the gold standard, and it gets the key child and the machine agree 73% of the time, and 95% of the time they agree on something other than the key child. So it's doing a very good job of finding the key child. And if you switch the thing, now the machine is the gold standard, so the columns sum to one instead of the rows summing to one, then you still get a pretty damn good agreement. The human listener agrees with the machine 64% of the time when it's the key child, and 97% of the time that it's something else. And even within the child vocalizations, we still have very tolerable levels of reliability. I mean, these are proportions of reliability. These are not kappas. But they're still quite indicative of high levels of agreement. So the SVI stands for speech-related vocal island, which means a syllable-like element that was identified as pertaining to the child vocalization. And then the cries and vegetative sounds are the other kinds of utterances that can occur within a child vocalization. And again, we get similar levels of agreement. So if something is said to be a syllable by the human listener, the machine agrees about 75% of the time, and so on. So we got really pretty good agreement about these things. And there's one more point I wanted to really make before I stop. And that's about how to sort of confirm this thing about how silence is utilized as the standard for determining FAR. So after the initial labeling of 8 categories is done, at some point later than that, the whole thing is rethought. And the machine goes back and rethinks the issue. And it asks the question, okay, I see that this thing has been labeled as male adult. How likely was it that it was male adult? Okay, compared to all the other 7 possibilities. Right? And it was the winner, but the real question is, how close was it to silence? So it brings the silence model over and it asks the question, how close was it to that one? If they're too close, then it's going to get labeled not MAN, but MAF, MAFAR. That happens to all 7 of the other models. Okay? They get compared to silence. And you ask the question, how different were they in terms of likelihood of being the right categorization? How likely were they with respect to the likelihood that silence was the right answer? And if they're too close, if the ratio is too low, then they get categorized as FAR. And that's what FAR means. In all of the analyses that you get on conversational terms, this is taken into account. Because the conversational terms are not about the FAR stuff. The FAR stuff gets treated as if it were noise. So when you're looking for conversational terms, what you're looking for is an alternation between male adult near or female adult near and child wearing the device near.
either in either order, but that's what you're looking for. Everything else gets treated as if it were garbage. Okay. And so even the pause duration issue is determined the same way, right? Yeah. So when I said you can't have silence more than 5 seconds, this stuff, it's not just silence. It's any of that garbage stuff, any of the far stuff, or the child not wearing the device, or any of the overlap, any of the stuff that is not a part of a potential conversation, which is to say male adult, female adult, child near. Those are the only ones that fit into the conversation. Everything else is potentially a part of the pause. Okay, so I stop there.
I've gone too long. You'll have time to talk with Jeff about this tomorrow, with Kim about this tomorrow, and the ADEX stuff. There are a lot. And you can talk with me after this evening if you want. But right now, what I want to do is introduce somebody else.